Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, depending on where you're joining us from. And welcome to today's webinar, Enterprise Risk Management /COSO, Supply Chain Management and Supply Chain Priority Setting. My name's Amy. I'm a member of the marketing team here at Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety, Inc. I'll be facilitating today's webinar and offering technical support to our speakers. Today, we're excited to be welcoming back a familiar face to our webinar. It's Dr. John Spink of MSU. We'll be introducing him to you shortly. But I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first speaker today. That is Paul DeMarin. He is the Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Supply Chain at PJRFSI. Paul joined us last year in January and has over 35 years of experience in the hospitality, service, and retail agri-food sectors. Paul is a board member of the OFPA, that's the Ontario Food Protection Association. He's also an advisory council member with the George Washington University School of Business for their digital marketing certificate program. And before he joined us here at PJRFSI, Paul worked for over 16 years in the certification industry with clients in sectors from food safety and supply chain to brand protection and quality. Paul has also worked in management system certification for many years. And before that, Paul was a professional chef and a consultant for over 20 years. So I will hand things over to you, Paul, and you can take it away when you're ready.
Great. Thank you very much, Amy. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here today. We really appreciate your time. I'm extremely excited to welcome back our friend and colleague, Dr. John, to today's webinar. As many of you might know, we've switched up the format of our webinar previously where we would give an overview of our organization. We are now foregoing that and going directly into our speaker content and expert content. So taking a look at all the webinars we've done in the last year, really the goal is to, help everybody understand who and what we are and how we can help. But I think that we've really achieved that. So as I mentioned, again, moving forward, our focus is going to be on the actual content that's discussed. So at this time, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. John Spink, who's the director. Hey, John, Director of Food Fraud Initiative and Assistant Professor of Supply Chain Management, the Business College at Michigan State University. Since 2013, John's been the director of the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State. His early research and industry engagement supported the foundation of food fraud prevention, including as a member of the GFSI Food Fraud Think Tank, and that developed their first compliance requirements, and also as the lead author on the article defining the public health threat of food fraud, which is most widely cited definition today. Also, their food fraud prevention, MOOC, or Massive Open Online Courses, are one of the most common training courses that are out in the market today. So with that, thank you again, John, and I will now pass it over to you, and I'll try and keep asking a few questions throughout as well, just to make it a little more interactive. So thanks for being here.
That's great. Thank you. As always, it's a pleasure to be here. Great to work with PJR always. It's been interesting. So those of you who know me, hopefully some of you know me, some of you don't. In this last 2 years, I've moved over to our supply chain department at Michigan State, the Business College. It's been a fabulous move, especially because we're starting to look at food fraud as management system and looking at it as a part of the bigger system. Also, really, the food fraud is about product fraud prevention, and that applies to all industries. So it's been fascinating. The other is I'm now teaching introduction to procurement. So when you complain about the purchasing managers don't understand the problems and the risks, well, we're starting to try to train them from the other side. So we're going to look at something a little bit different this time, and it's going to be as we go through the certifications, the GFSI, BRC, FSSC 22000, SQF, IFS, and others, you start to implement it, and then you get a big moment where you kind of say, now what? And so you've got the processes in place, and how much is enough is a real big question for you, for your proposal, and also for your company to figure out how much is enough. Well, how much is too much? because nobody has unlimited amount of resources. So we're going to look at the concept of enterprise risk management, COSO. They're managerial accounting practices that are in place. They're required for every public company in the U.S. So you can't say if you're a public company, you don't do it, because you do. But the question is how it applies to your business. And we take that in to look at things like supply chain management and whole supply chain priority setting. And I think it's important to us to think about product fraud, food fraud, as a bigger picture, a bigger issue, as a supply chain problem, a food supply chain problem, not just as a food issue or a food safety issue. So we'll get started here. Okay. I'll get used to it. So here's the title slide again. My information is there, foodfraudprevention.com. If you want to communicate about anything, all of our resources are there. So interesting to look back to see what we've talked about before. So from the previous video libraries, it was way back early on in 2018, seems like a million years ago now, just kind of basically what you needed to know about food fraud. And then we advanced through to look at the specific audit. That's interesting to think about how people are auditing you. What are what's the guidance for the auditors, so you know how you can prepare for them. Then we took a little bit of a different angle and looked specifically at packaging. And then the previous one was looking at COVID and food fraud and COVID overall. So I went back and looked at those to make sure to complement those as we move forward. Real briefly about me, research, education is out and outreach. That's the cycle. So even us talking before starting the webinar now, there's a few things I learned that's going to go back into research, into education and teaching. The food fraud prevention textbook. So if you're dealing with food fraud at your company, this was developed as a resource, comprehensive resource, a lot of background, a lot of guidance there. And then the training, as was mentioned, the MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses, free. The content's always free. We're trying to educate as many people as possible so you know the basics. Four of them we've been offering for many years, the first one since 2013. And then getting into more detail, such as the vulnerability assessment. Beyond that is a new one. Well, now it's a year old, I guess, developing organic fraud prevention plan with the Organic Trade Association. And then just at the beginning of this year was an enterprise risk management MOOC, which fits exactly with the content today. I actually went back to the MOOC and pulled out content. So what you see here today is just a very short version of that that'll provide more detail and steps for you, really. And then really exciting for us is two MOOCs that we did, online training with the USDA National Organic Program. So these are prepared for the USDA and specifically for them to train their inspectors. Key with that is that if you're getting inspected, you'd like to know what they're looking at. So I'll have some links for that. And then we have a lot of, usually we have executive education, work with people, and then there's a lot of information on our website. So just to remind you again, actually some people that I've mentioned several times, they haven't really looked at this, but go to the Organic Integrity Learning Center. You can register for free and get access here. A lot of work went into this with USDA, with Organic Trade Association and others. And the two courses, they're really different than any other courses that we put together because they were so focused. One is this organic fraud in the criminal mind. That was to step back and really give education about the criminals. I always wanted to do a MOOC on criminology, but hadn't done that yet. So that really went into that one. And the next one is preventing organic fraud opportunity, looking at very specific details, issues with the things like certifications and others. So just really was a great body of work, I think. And those all fit into this overall idea. I think along the way, it's been interesting to see the research evolve. And now that you get systems in place, you've got inspectors coming to visit you, you've got these things going on, you now start to think about, well, you're proposing changes and you need to have some resources. And that gets to be the real question of how much is enough. That's the problem statement we'll cover here. Oh, really, how much is wasteful and too much? There's really truly no such thing as zero risk. If you're in the food industry, you do accept some level of risk. If you sell a product that's raw, if you use dairy, other things like that, then you definitely have a certain threshold for risk. But we manage our risks a lot. And so we have a zero tolerance for doing stupid things. We have a zero tolerance for releasing product that has a hazard that requires a preventive control. But there is a level of risk. We need to figure out then how to balance that across the company. And that's what we'll cover here today. So here's the big issue. And a lot of times it was hard for me to get down to the bottom line. And we'll review this as the last slide to make sure I cover it. But if your CFO can spend $1 million on only one project, should this be for your project? Because you give proposals all the time. Oh, we should do this, we should do that. But is your, if they could only choose one project, is yours the one that you should choose? Now, should you do it? Yes. Should I have had two donuts for breakfast? No, but I went for a run, and so it kind of balanced out. Now, so what should you do? Did I have to do it? No. Did I have to go for a run? Did I have to, you know, should I have not had the donuts? Well, sure. But the key is you trying to be able to propose that, just to say, not just to say, here's a project, but to be able to compare that and to be able to talk about how you compare this to all other investments at your company. And you do, do you have limited resources? No, nobody does anywhere. Next is, should you know that question for the CFO? Well, that's an interesting question because, can you know about your entire company? Well, you can't, right? But the question is, do they know more than you know about your problem than you do? You're a food scientist. You're a food safety professional. You have a food chemistry background. Do you think your CFO has a food chemistry, food safety background? No, they don't. So you know more about your project, and you're the one that can have the most impact on explaining the real need for that project. But there's something you need to consider. And the key is, do you know about all their problems? The key is, this proposal is, it might be important, but it needs to be considered in relation to all other problems or investments at your company. That gets to be really difficult. Now, you could say, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to submit the proposal, let them figure it out. But the thing is, then you're relying on them to be, to understand your problem. You're relying on chance, really. So it's really important and most optimal for you as a good manager to understand their problems, to try to figure it out. Put your proposal in their terms so they can make a real clear understanding. The key is, we want them to make a logical decision. But how can you know the answers? So you're not a CFO. You're not your CFO. You might have a financial background, but you're not. But that's specifically what we're going to cover today. So as you look at the proposal or the agenda, you have a system in place. We'll say, if you're GFSI compliant, that's the prevention strategy, vulnerability assessment, but you've got this question then of how much is enough. Test once, twice, 100 times, and then when you define what's a medium, is your medium when you're looking at food fraud, is a medium risk for food fraud the same as a medium risk for food safety? If it's not, then you've got multiple scales going on here. If you're the CFO, how are you going to figure out if your proposal, if even you might yourself be giving a medium risk for food safety and a different medium risk for food fraud? Well, that's even confusing for your team, let alone theirs. And the key is to look at how to calibrate, and really to do that is utilizing processes. So we'll dig into that in a minute. So, okay, you've got, if you're compliant with GFSI, you've got the vulnerability assessment and prevention strategy documents. And so, okay, you have those. Now what? The big thing is that it's decision time. It's time to spend money. It's time to propose for those projects. Now think back, when you give proposals, do you have a 10% success rate, 100%, 90%? Do you think other people get more money? Does your company invest illogically? And maybe they should invest more in your area. But that's a real key for us to figure out how decisions are made. And that's why we need to keep going beyond this point, beyond just having these assessments and these reviews, to one step further. So what we'll do is looking at this idea of assessing the incidents and this whole idea of the ranking itself. So overall, you try to do your rank order. So you find five incidents and you rank them in order from top to bottom. And so then you plot them somehow. You figure the worst one's very high risk and somehow you plot them. But the question here is, which one should be acted upon? Now, this looks clearly that red and orange zone are really bad. Those should be acted upon. Those are the worst problems. But a key is, right now you're defining food fraud problems in relation to other food fraud problems. That's interesting, but that doesn't help the CFO, the financial decision makers, look at your entire company and to compare this with everything else. That's where we then need to go one step further to say, is a high for food fraud on your assessment the same as a high for food safety, or the same as a high risk for anything across your company? So now which one should be acted upon? When, let's say that we did try to recalibrate. Now look at that scale on the right. Those are still the five food fraud problems ranked in order, but we've calibrated it against all other risks. And a lot of times food fraud, I mean, if it's a suspicious activity, it doesn't have a known health hazard. If you know that there's salmonella in your product and people are sick, that is a very high, very high, no question. So the very high, very high for food fraud might not be calibrated the same. So we definitely see this a lot of times. People spread out the assessments on the left there, and then on the right is sometimes where the reality is. Not always, but sometimes. But the key is now trying to figure that, as it says in the titles there, food fraud versus food fraud risk, and on the right, food fraud versus all risks. So how do you deal with those? So first off, we'll take a break here and see if there's any questions. I definitely want to take any questions.
Hey, John, I wanted to ask a question with respect to, you were talking about the organic learning program, and I just wanted to ask, who's the intended audience for the USDA organic training programs? I mean, I'm sure it's the inspectors, but it'd be good to have an understanding of what the inspectors are going to look at when they visit.
Yeah, that's a great question. And originally USDA did focus that, well, they needed first training for their inspectors. And a lot of this came about from discussions of what wasn't in the marketplace. And for us even, we didn't focus on specifically the National Organic Program, or because organic is not just food, it's all organic products. Could be dietary supplements, could be clothing, could be health and beauty products, soap. Shampoo, not that I need that, but I do use soap, so organic soap. It's all products, and they have a different set of issues. So they originally were looking at educating their inspectors to then define what is a competent inspection. But along the way, we realized that if you're a company and you're going to get inspected, you'd like to also know what they're going to do when the inspector comes, because the goal of the inspectors. And the goal of the National Organic Program is not to catch people, not catch people doing wrong things. It's to encourage compliance and to encourage good systems in place. So we really realize that if we train the inspectors, but then think of this as also training for the people, then it's going to make the inspections that much more smooth, because you're going to know exactly what they're looking for. And you're going to be able to develop the systems that meet those needs. And when they come in, they're going to be able to see those common terms, concepts, the appropriate depth for you getting inspected. So they were developed for the USDA inspectors themselves, but really, they're really so great to apply directly to you. Look, this is what's so great about food fraud prevention, is that there's so much collaboration. And we're all moving towards the same goal of preventing it. And that's a real key. I mean, in that organic program, the title is preventing organic product fraud. It's not catching it. And it really does look at vulnerabilities as we're looking as well. Any others that popped up yet?
Yeah, no, this presentation is very timely. There's a lot of talk in the industry right now about enterprise risk management. How, in your opinion, does ERM apply to the GFSI requirements?
That's another great question, because, there's all these new concepts, but the question is, well, how much is enough? Why do it? You've got plenty of things on your plate. I think like all of us, you're not sitting around looking for things to do. One of my big goals for this year is to do more of less. I want to have fewer projects, but work more on them. And everybody's looking at that as a goal. So really, when you look back at GFSI, GFSI's requirements from the GFSI document are very, very light. And then people like BRC, SQF, FSSC, IFS, they give you more detail. A key is when you get to the point of doing the assessment, the vulnerability assessment, ERM and COSO is a method that will help you be efficient to create those vulnerability assessments. And that's a perfect question as we lead into kind of the next section even. So unless there's another burning question, we'll move on to kind of answering that.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. Let's move on, and I'll talk to I have another question later.
Okay, so the key is there then to say, okay, we've got GFSI requirements. We've got this idea, we've got the system in place. We're looking at how much is enough. So what I said at the end there is, which should be acted upon, how do you set those those limits? And then how do you actually start to figure out how to talk to the CFO? And that's where enterprise risk management fits in perfectly. The really root of this happened with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, SOX or SARBOX. And corporations have control systems called internal controls and integrated frameworks. Again, if you're a public company, this is done at your company, regardless of whether you know about it or not. It's required. It's a compliance requirement. There's training certification of that. And it's U.S. law since 2002, and it requires a process. It doesn't define exactly which one you need to use or how you to do it, but it requires a process. And along the way, this COSO group, which was a committee of other associations, created the enterprise risk management concept. So one type of those processes is enterprise risk management. More on that later. So again, whether you're a public company or private company, there are oversight requirements. So Sarbanes-Oxley is required for public companies in the U.S. So if you're a private company in the U.S., doesn't mean you don't have anything going on. Unless you have an owner that owns the company itself and makes all the decisions, there's going to be some type of oversight with your board of directors. If you're outside the U.S., there's still going to be some type of oversight. Anybody that invests in your company is going to want to be comfortable with your and understand your level of risk and how you're managing it. So Sarbanes-Oxley forced this COSO ERM to be developed, and that then led to common practices across the enterprise, but across industry. So not having an ERM system in place could be criminal, literally, because it's a violation of law.
Hey, John, can I ask you a real quick question?
Sure.
I really liked your slide on risk ranking as well. I think that was very relevant and made a lot of sense. But if you're, you know, a company today, how or what do you suggest is the best way to estimate what the company considers, say, a medium risk versus a high, or, you know, what's more important, a food safety risk versus an all risk?
Yeah, that's great. Actually, it's a perfect time to ask that question in here as well. Because those are real questions. So yes, you know you're supposed to do a vulnerability assessment, and what all these great tools out there will give you a recommendation for food fraud of what is a medium. But that's a medium in a general sense, not in your sense, not specifically for your company. Your company may have a much higher risk tolerance or lower risk tolerance in general. You may do some other things that control the systems a lot more. You may have a kill step that's just incredible that you know eliminates a lot of the food safety issues. That's where having this overall process is key, because this is where at the board, the people that invest in your company. So if you invest in a mutual fund and they invest in a food company, multinational food company, then you're the owner. You're the one that decides whether you want to keep that mutual fund. And through that mutual fund of if this company is being too risky or not, that's where we set this level of where this risk tolerance is. And this gets specifically back to enterprise risk, actually specifically to this slide right here. So great, great timing here. So is this serious for you or for your company? Well, when companies identify and define their risk tolerance, because you're thinking about investing in the company, they define their risk tolerance. This is the 10K form. You can look this up on Google it, 10K form or 10Q form. That's quarterly forms or annual forms for Sarbanes-Oxley. So here online is the CEO and CFO, this happens to be Kellogg Company from 2017. They posted this statement and signed it. And they said that we're managing our risks within this threshold set by our board of directors, which is set by the owners of the company, the stockholders, people like us that own mutual funds. So at the very top, they identify that they've got things under control. At that point, then they look at to say, okay, what is acceptable level of risk? When you buy a blue chip stock, you're not expecting it to go up 1,000%. You're also not expecting it to go down 50% or 80%. There's a certain level of control there, and that's a risk tolerance. That's what they're starting to state, that they're meeting this and managing it. And the key is overall, you know, a business is a financial entity, even a nonprofit organization. And overall businesses are financial entities judged by financial metrics. That's the bottom line. And while the main focus of a food company is obviously food, it is a business. And then it's a business, is a financial entity judged by those financial measures. And even a non-profit enterprise has a budget. And that's a real key to think about. You think, oh, well, you know, we give away things. Well, still you have a budget and you don't give away more than you have. You don't spend more than you bring in. And these really top-down regulation, there are the top-down regulation and controls are on these business functions. So that from the corporation, they're looking at the entire entity. So these specific, there are specific and unique requirements for those for financial reporting. And again, that's where we start to build up these risks. The questions that you have in food safety and food fraud build up to then assure that in those 10K, 10Q forms that you are, your company has things under control and within the tolerance of what's acceptable. Now, this might seem like we're getting to way into financial issues, but you'll see it's going to come back to us in food fraud very quickly. The big thing is back to, if there's one project for $1 million, is your project the one that should get funded? The key is that we, with enterprise risk, we have a way to connect everything to everything. And that's where we really needed a way to coordinate this. And this is called internal controls. So everybody does the same, similar types of assessments. And there's an integrated framework. And that then connects people together to understand that we can judge and track some of these controls and systems across the company. And remember, the systems got out of control in the past. That's why we have Sarbanes-Oxley. You know, anytime there's a law or regulation, something comes out, it happens because someone did something that was a problem in the past. And that was really, if you remember back Enron. Actually, I was living in Houston at the time in the middle of that. I knew people that were working at Enron. It was a really amazing time in the marketplace just to see everything going on. But others were there, Parmalat, WorldCom, and others, even the subprime lending crisis. Those all led to reasons why we have these controls. What's important for us is that these controls are in place and serious. We can use those when we're trying to identify how much is enough for food fraud prevention. And formally, really, what we're looking at here is there's these over... Let's talk about what is ERM, because a lot of people are starting to talk about enterprise risk management. We need to be really clear what we're talking about. So when I say you should do ERM, I don't mean the formal enterprise risk management, full implementation, full certification by COSO. Now, some companies decide to do that, but there's a lot of reasons why that's a challenge. And you don't need to do it for food fraud because it's extremely complex, time-consuming, resource-intensive, like mad, extremely costly. But it is a very thorough and intricate interconnected activities. It's really efficient for a lot of companies, finance, insurance, other types of companies that deal with a lot of issues like that have very, very robust systems. We're not talking about full formal ERM, and that's usually really a really formally implemented at the very high level. So a lot of companies only have that at the very high levels. And we kind of mean more this ERM-like or ERM-light. So there's a lot of people that will not have the full enterprise risk management certification, the COSO certification, but they'll do a simpler version and implement the concepts. Some activities, but not officially certified. What we're really talking about here, and I should probably be more clear about that, is ERM-type processes. That's the key that we then... You know, you're not in fully the ERM system, but you can use the processes. So when these feed upward into the system, then you're using terms and concepts that will apply to the enterprise systems. And it utilizes those processes and methods supported by the formal system. And this is what we really are recommending here. So again, ERM is a huge system, very formal. It would be like a full-blown HACCP system. You know, that's not just you doing a bunch of temperature measurements. That's a huge system, and there's a lot to it. This would be just looking at the processes. So we kind of went to the basics and went back to this robust system for financial analysis, and now we take the point of applying it to food fraud. So if you've followed some of my previous works, then this corkscrew approach is going to be familiar, and hopefully this makes more sense now. When we talk about the corkscrew approach, what we mean is that at the very beginning, when we're dealing with food fraud specifically, there's limited direction on how much is enough. You know, GFSI definitely doesn't have a threshold or a limit. It says you need to do the assessment and figure out the problems that are too unacceptable. And even in the systems, the general systems that are in place to apply, they basically have high, medium, low, but they're giving you general ideas. There's that really limited direction. So what we recommend here is starting light, but do a complete assessment. Now, what we mean by that is in a corkscrew, go all the way around and then see if you need to go deeper. So cover all products in your company, look at those at a very high level, maybe five big groups, and then you figure out which ones are a problem, and those are the ones you go deeper. And remember, GFSI does require assessments for all types of fraud and for all products. That's incoming goods, that's outgoing goods, it's product in the marketplace, it's raw materials, it's everything at any point. It's all types of fraud. Could be labeling, could be stolen goods, could be counterfeits and others. Go as deep as you need to go, determined by your risk allocation decision makers or the auditors and inspectors. So let's say that you have an issue, melamine in infant formula and pet food. And you did an assessment, you figured that it's unacceptable at the levels that it is, and you recommended a certain set of tests to do for incoming goods. Now, if you went to your resource decision maker and asked for that $1 million and they immediately came back and accepted it, you don't need to go deeper. You don't need any more level of detail. Now, they may come back and say, well, we're comparing this against some other things and we don't know if we should give you $500,000 or $1 million or what, then they're gonna ask you more specific questions. At that point, you went around once, you gave them the proposal, they ask you for more, you go down again all the way around and keep going until they have enough information to make a decision. And a decision is yes or no. That's where we start to can apply these ERM concepts, because at the very beginning, at the very top, that's pretty light and pretty quick. As you go down with more and more information, it's becoming more and more robust. It's becoming a very detailed assessment. And within these requirements, there's a definition of a two-stage assessment. And the first is an initial screen. So if you and I sat down and did an assessment, just things off the top of our head, using our expert insight, that's acceptable. That's an initial screen. We could do that right now. We could do that within an hour. And the bottom line is you would already have that first iteration. You'd have the first level of review. So it's okay to do that. It's allowed. But at this point, you still don't really believe that or feel good about that. So we're going to cover that in a couple more slides to give you more confidence. Start, and we actually published a paper on this, introducing the food fraud initial screening tool. So there is already a scholarly publication, actually several years old now. So before moving on, we'll stop to take a break. I'll have a sip of water here, and you can ask me if there's any questions that came up.
I know, John, that for the audience questions, we generally open that up at the end just for audio clarity. But I did have one question where you're referring to the initial screening. Can you confirm who actually has the authority to conduct the initial screening?
Wow. Okay. There's a great question. Can I do one? Am I allowed to do one? Well, if you're doing the vulnerability assessment for food fraud, then you're asked to do it. So you're starting to do that assessment. The question then is when you look at that to say, well, which assessment do I do? And you can look at, there's a lot of great resources out there. And now that we've got this published, an initial screening is something you just use this as a method. That's partially the reason why we published the article, because now you could just refer to this webinar and our article to say this was one of the types of assessments that's out there that we'll conduct. So we basically, we enabled you to use whatever tool you felt is comfortable. And this initial screening is definitely public. But the thing that's important about it is that it feeds up into this enterprise risk management. These are enterprise risk management terms and concepts. That's why it's called an initial screen, because ERM calls it an initial screen. So if a CFO or someone that's really certified and trained at ERM sees you calling something an initial screening, they're going to know exactly what that means. That doesn't mean you've got a million data points and it's a probabilistic risk assessment. It means it's an initial screen. It's a first review of that. Actually, that's a great question leading right into this. So that will help me with the focus on the next slides even. So putting it into practice, this is a report on the upper right you'll see from ERM, from COSO. And when they talk about putting it into practice, this is the part that enables you to do this. You and I could sit down together and do an official initial screening. And it really is looking at this as a starting point. It's generally, so CFO, if they see these problems, they do these type of assessments frequently, or the team that works for the CFO. Generally, what are we looking at here? Not so bad or really bad. The Suez Canal, when the ship got stuck, a lot of people did these very high-level initial screenings, trying to get a gut feel, like, over lunch period to figure out how bad is bad. So it's right there that it's talking about it in the document that it's okay to do it light. And you think of this analogy of checking the weather outside. You know what kind of scale? If I say, what's the weather like? Well, is it going to snow tomorrow, or is it going to be 80 degrees? Is it raining in an hour or not? If I'm running to my car, I don't need to know exactly the barometric pressure. Just let me know if it's raining now. And a lot of times with these initial screens at the start, that's as light as it needs to be at the start. Now later, if we're starting to go on a camping trip, we may want to know a little bit more. But that's more information. That's a more detailed assessment than that initial screen of glancing outside at the window. And really, what they're doing here is they're just trying to get a mental set, a mindset of what's coming. And so it's a very, very high level, again, a very, very early look at the issue. Also, if it's perceived as a very impactful activity, the C-suite may feel it's crucial to immediately update and warn the board of directors. That's a real key. So like if something comes in and they're doing an initial screen and they figure Suez Canal ship is blocked and you've got product on that ship, or product right in front of it or behind it, it may disrupt your sales. And that's something that the board, you want to be the one letting the board of directors know of problems, not having them call you and ask about those issues. So these are why a lot of times these really quick initial screenings do happen frequently. So you're okay doing them because people have done them at the top. Next, to give you just a little bit more about this two-stage process. So some people think that we made this up. We didn't. We looked at resources to try to help figure out what was valuable, what was out there already as a standard operating procedure. So in this, this is the section on assessing risk. Again, in a COSO branded published document on their website, they say here that risk assessment is often performed in a two-stage process. So right there, it's in black and white that they're talking about it. An initial screening, there's a term you already know, of the risks and opportunities performed using qualitative techniques, qualitative words, assessments, high, medium, low. That fits into this category because, again, it's an initial screening, followed by a more quantitative treatment of the most important risks. Couple things there is look first you look across the entire enterprise. So let's say you do a food fraud assessment and you look at five product groups coming from five different types of suppliers. 5x5 is a type of matrix we use at the start. When you look across all those 25 items, cells, then you're going to have a couple that are the worst. And though you want to look at your entire business in total and then to figure out which ones you really need to focus on. And that leads you to find, say, three areas that are really bad. Then you'll go into detail in those three. And part of this then is you going deeper because you've already identified which ones are worst. But then also when you start to go to make a decision, you get information from the decision maker themselves. So this is where when we saw COSO, it was perfect for applying the methods, not necessarily the full-blown ERM system, but applying the ERM type processes fit exactly what we needed. So conducting that assessment. So that's all theoretical ERM, finance speak. But one thing we did, I think, is kind of our role is to then apply it into food fraud. And you'll see there's the slide, the cover slide from the MOOC. So we've got a two-hour webinar program on that, goes through a lot of details and walks you through the process of what was published in that paper. And the key is getting to something that looks very familiar, like we saw earlier, a couple slides earlier, was there that heat map. And that's now that heat map is calibrated. It's not just food fraud related to food fraud issues. It's food fraud related to enterprise-wide issues. And we walk through some of these ways to calibrate that. A key is then if you set a medium and say it's $1 million of loss once a month, then that's a very much more specific number for that estimate. And now you have something to talk about with the CFO team or the ERM team to really figure out how to calibrate that. And so you can see the details of in the VASP training for more. And what we're doing here is, again, we're converting your food fraud ranks to the enterprise risk ranks, and you're plotting them on this corporate risk map. At this point, you now can say that item that's in the upper left C is in the red zone. That's clearly intolerable risk, very high, and it's related to those intolerable risks of your enterprise. You can go to the CFO and say, we've identified three items that are in the red zone, intolerable risks for our companies that we must deal with. Now you can state definitively that. Now, when they look at this, they'll help to figure to calibrate if you really did get them exactly right. But now you're talking in their terms. You're crystal clear that these ones are truly intolerable. And then you apply it to this enterprise risk management and rank your first, when you do your first initial screenings and deeper vulnerability assessments. You now are calibrating with the enterprise. From the very beginning, when you apply these right away, when you look at a new incident, new issue, you know you have more tools to understand how bad is bad. Of course, every food fraud incident is a concern, but then is it one that you need to call the president of your division right away or not?
And John, how would you use that initial screening when you make a request to management?
That's a great point. So let's say that horse meat and beef just occurred. You just heard about it. So you just got a tweet or however you get your alerts. Then with your team, the first thing you should always be thinking about how you not is that bad, but that you should go through the assessment. So the first thing to do is then to get out your vulnerability assessment tool, and you start to plot to look at the likelihood and consequence. Now, if you have if you do species tests on the product that comes in, or let's say you buy from three of the biggest meat distributors, producers, whatever that are GFSI strategic partners, then you would look at either your supply or your testing to realize that the likelihood is probably very low that you would get any horse meat. So look over there, that's a VL, very low. And then the consequence, if you did get it, well, you already have these, if they did happen to send the product in, you already have a lot of testing for species, and you're already buying from people that are very diligent as well. So most likely it's a very low likelihood that you would get that horse meat, even if it's though it's happening in the world, and you knew it was happening across Europe, but for you, it would be a very low likelihood. And the consequence would be low or very low because, again, the traceability systems you'd have with your suppliers. So the immediately is how you would use this is that you would then, that I mean, you could do that just on the phone in 15 minutes with your team. You estimate by initial screening that the horse meat incident, even though it's running rampant across Europe, causing tons of problems, massive recalls, you estimate that for you, it's down in the blue zone. The way you would communicate that is then, I mean, number one is you want to be telling the bosses about a risk. You don't want them to be calling you. Your VP, your CEO doesn't want to hear from the board of directors saying, hey, I'm in London and I'm reading about this horse meat. What are we doing? You want to be telling them. So at that point then, very quickly you could shoot that, you could send that initial screening up to say, hey, FYI, here's an article we just read in the newspaper, wherever, an alert about horse meat and beef. We ran an assessment. It looks like through the initial screening that we're at a very low. And so we're just going to monitor it. That, think about that. That really is so competent because you've done the assessment, but you also are talking about what you're doing to make sure that it is down in that level. So great question about how to use it. That's really a practical question. I get that also does lead into the next slide. People then start to be interested in how to, how do you figure out how deep to go? And this is a slide I've used frequently. So some of you may have seen it before. But what we're talking about the initial screen is that we've got on the left there. So let's say we did this initial screen. I'm calling this for incoming goods for your entire company. And you've got, say, A, B, C, D, E are all types of products. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are types of suppliers. So let's say that you did look across, and again, it could be just expert panel, could be just us talking about it. And we find that this product under B2, cell B2, and there you see obviously D4 is the other red zone. So D2 is, there's just clearly two that are the worst across your entire company. So those are ones that you would go deeper. Now, you don't have to look at every one of these. Look at how many there are in the blue and the green zone. That means you're in pretty good shape for those. But those in the red zone, you'd go deeper. So let's take that one that's B2. Let's say that's domestic suppliers of fruit. Now we go deeper. So this detail would be, it was that one cell was domestic suppliers for fruit. So let's say across the top is domestic suppliers from different states. And let's say number three is Michigan. And then going down A, B, C, D, E, Michigan, that could be cherries. Michigan cherries. So now this is of course a simplistic model, but so that one at the very top level, there were two red zone items that you dug deeper. You dug into one of those, and there's only one cell that's the problem. At that point, then you dig even deeper. So now for all the cherries in all of Michigan, you now start to look at maybe you have five suppliers. One's me, John. John's Michigan tart cherries. And that number two on the left is frozen. So now you dug all the way down. Again, I'll admit that I'm being simplistic, but when you went down to the detail, there was only one supplier with one type of product that was a problem that fed all the way up to your corporate level, to the overall risk assessment. And the key is you dig down, how far is enough to dig down in that corkscrew? Until you have you drill down until until one decision changes it. So right there, stop buying John's frozen tart cherries. Bing! That cell goes to a green because you measure that by not buying from me. Everything else was fine though, remember? Now let's go back up a level and rerun it up one. Bing! It's green again because again, the root cause isn't there anymore. Let's go back up to the corporate level. Bing! Now one of the two reds, since you proposed that change, is now a green. You go back then to look at defining, you know, how much enough detail to that one risk treatment can change the rank, and then you go back and you change and you update the overall risk assessment. At that point, then the proposal is that we did this. We had a problem in our marketplace with two cells here. We dug into that. Our recommendation is to stop buying from this crazy guy in Michigan who's selling us the cherries. And if we do that, then our risk tolerance will go to zero. Now, the proposal is to stop buying from me, but maybe I've got really low-priced cherries. It might cost you more to find another supplier. That's then going to be the proposal for the cost. So what we wanted to show here really is just this, how you would take this into practice and dig all the way down and then come back up and apply it. And right there, then think about that, is you don't need a lot of detail or data or statistical probabilistic risk assessment to say we've got one supplier that's a problem, we should stop buying from them. Now, there could be other issues that you might need more data, but for that question, you wouldn't need that. And this is a very, very typical question and very typical response. That's the efficiency of using this initial screening, just to drill down quickly back up, and then if it goes to green, then you're in good shape. So to review again back the original question before the call to action in the next slide is, so let's see if we actually cover this. So if your CFO can spend $1 million on only one project, should this be for your project? Well, now you're getting a feel for the big picture there. So you know you don't have unlimited resources. Should you know? Well, maybe not, but it's really efficient if you do. That if you can now define these terms, you do that first assessment and identify. Remember that slide one before, there were only two cells that were in the red zone, and you're focused on those. You've calibrated that those are the worst problems for your entire company. You know which ones to deal with, not the other ones. You need to deal with those two before doing anything else. Do they know more than you about your problem, than you do about your problem? No. But you just told them, you boiled it down, that you have had these two major problems, and it was stop buying from one supplier. That's pretty simple. I think even a CFO, a finance person, can understand that one. So as I teach to many finance students, I joke with them about that. But do you know about all their other problems? No. But the key is if you do send that proposal up and say, we think this is in the red zone because this likelihood and this consequence, they'll help you calibrate, say, well, that's not quite there yet. That's not really a red yet, where it's really a yellow. So all of a sudden, you've started to figure that out. As you make that proposal in their terms, you can refine yourself to figure out what gets funded and what doesn't and why. And how can you know the answer? Basically, you run it up the flagpole, you give the proposal, and they will then give you feedback. If you think it's red zone and you're talking about it and they don't fund it, then there's something about your assessment that was off, right? And that's what you're figuring. So, call to action, what to do now. So we've done all this theory on finance and business and management. First thing is review your food fraud vulnerability assessment and make sure it's updated. Number one. You know, we're no longer just at the beginning of the year anymore, being April, just past tax day. But you really need to do a full vulnerability assessment for your entire company, initial screening across the board at the very high level. Again, there's resources that can help you do that. You need to do that before you get started on anything else. Review your risk ranks versus what you perceive as the enterprise level. Seek training to support your task. What I mean by that is then, so you're doing your vulnerability assessment. Now start to think about what projects over the last year got funded or not. And then where would you have ranked those before or after getting funding? That'll help you to understand the reality of where that threshold is. Or think about proposals that you gave that you didn't get any good feedback on, or ones that got immediately approved or good questions. You're starting to figure out what those risk ranks are. What's the most efficient way for you to explain the risk that they can act upon it? And then ask yourself if you can compare these risks to all other risks. Start to think about other things. So look around your company. Think about the things that did get funded. Maybe a new filler was purchased. Maybe that you bought a company. Maybe you had layoffs. What got funded or unfunded? And then try to figure out why those were or weren't funded. You know, like what's the level of return that your business got off that? That will just give you a little bit more of an idea of what and where they're spending their money. Process, repeat. Plan, do, check, act. That's the quality management process, right? So you've been through the vulnerability assessments before. Go through it again. Start to apply this initial screening to look at enterprise-wide concepts and keep going and keep repeating the cycle. You learn every time you go through it. I can't emphasize enough to go back and make sure you're doing the enterprise-level overall vulnerability assessment, even if it's just an initial screening, every year. Do that just to look to see if the same issues are there, and then start to really focus downwards. You do that by doing a gap analysis to see what you're doing and then updating the assessment. So there we go. I think I went past a slide. So really there to open it up before that final slide that you have there. Paul, Amy, any other questions?
Thank you. Okay, no problem. Yeah, no problem, John. Thank you very much for that. Let me just quickly see. Oh, I think Amy, maybe you have control. Maybe just bring up the webinar slide, Amy, just before we move on. These are a couple upcoming webinars that we have this week and next week as well. So please do feel free to jump on and join us for those. We're really looking forward to it, and they should be some great discussions. Okay, so again, thank you very much, John. I'm going to pass this over to Amy so we can open it up for some audience Q&A.
Absolutely. Let me go ahead and pull up that Q&A slide here. All right, let's see, opening up the questions tab. If you had any other questions and you haven't gotten them in yet, please do so now. I hate to miss anyone's questions before we wrap things up. All right, John, let's see, I've got here, how would you define risk management and what are the key benefits?
Oh, you know, I love that question because I constantly ask the simplest questions and I'm constantly baffling people because they don't know some of those simple answers. Mm-hmm. So let's go back. That's really important to say to go back to the basics. So risk management in broad concepts is a couple things. It's really just having a structured way, methodical way to review the potential impacts on your business. Now, actually, risk is positive and negative. So that could be value creation or value preservation is what ERM calls it. So growth of the business or protecting it from loss. Think about it that if you start a new product, there's risk to it. If you buy a stock, there's risk in there as well. You're looking for the upside. So overall risk management is having a structured way to manage risk. Do that by identifying problems, having a way to assess those problems, having a way to manage them, meaning reduce them, and then communicate it internally as well. Every company is going to have some type of standard that they use. You know, if it's HACCP for food safety, that's a risk management system. In reality, it's quality management system, and risk is a part of that, or it's going to be defined at the very high level. Was there two parts to the question, or was it just really that first?
It was how do you define risk management? What are the key benefits?
Oh, yeah. So the key benefit is that you want to optimize resources. That's not minimize risk, actually. it's optimize your resources. So let's say that you, if you are investing in a stock, you know, right now, do you, or you're investing, you've got money. Say you've got $1 million and you're going to invest. You just won the lottery, you're going to invest it. So do you buy right now in the market, do you buy into a mutual fund? Do you buy gold? Do you just put it in the bank? Or do you buy a stock? Do you buy a company? What do you do with $1 million? Then that's about deciding what your level of risk threshold, your tolerance. If you think the market's going to go up, then you put the money in the market. If you've got a great business and you think putting $1 million into it is going to get you more of a benefit, then you invest it there. And that's the part about the benefit is that you now have a structured way, methodical way to decide the best way to optimize your business. And that's the real key piece is looking at this in the big picture. And that's defined by the people that own your company. And bottom line is if you own mutual funds, you and I are the ones that own and direct these companies, because if a company's underperforming, we sell the stock. Great question.
Absolutely. All right. We've got a question here about ERM programs. I've heard previously, as well as today during the webinar, about several different ERM programs. Which risk management certification, in your opinion, is the best?
The one that your board of directors picked. in all seriousness, it's not up to us to pick that. Different people. It's like saying which food safety standard is the best one for you. If you're in the meat business, is different than if you're a retailer. So all of them have different aspects of it. So that's at the very high level. But I'd say maybe the question is more with food fraud, which one is the best to use? And that's a bit of a loaded question. There's a lot of options out there. What I do think is that, like with enterprise risk management, start simple. And start at the very high level with very simple assessments yourself. And then as you get more detailed, you're going to know more about the questions you have, about the competence you have, about the risk that you have. And then you're going to be able to make a better decision about which system that you buy into. Let's think about like a car, a vehicle. So if you're living in like us, state of Michigan, driving up north in the winter, you're going to want a four-wheel drive. But you could get a car, you could get a sedan, you could get a van, you could get a whatever. Then the question is, how many people in the car and how much weight are you going to be pulling? Are you going to be pulling a boat in the winter or the summer? All of a sudden, then you can't decide which car is best for you until you know exactly what your needs are. If you live in the state of Florida, you don't need to have winter tires, snow tires. So that's the key, is at the very beginning, do the first assessment. Just get a feel at the very high level, then you'll understand your problem a lot more, and then you'll be able to decide which system is best for you.
All right, great. We've got a couple more questions here. What is the importance of ERM in the overall strategy of the company?
Yeah, so that it's interesting. So at the very high level, so the board of directors. They are, so if you own a stock, the mutual fund holds the board of directors as your proxy. They're representing you to the company. They're representing your investment in the company. So the board of directors looks at the business itself, and they look at the CEO, the presidents of the divisions, the VPs, and they say, look, we're expecting you to operate within a certain level. A certain level of risk, a certain level of culture, a certain level of competencies. But then the VPs say, well, what are you expecting? What are you expecting from us? And that's where the back and forth is then to define clearly that, like, that level of risk. So there's going to be a risk committee, which is going to be the board of directors and then probably some VPs that really look at the risks of the companies. And what they want to see is across all the investments, say you have five different businesses, across those five businesses, that everyone is operating at the optimal level of risk. Meaning that some people, like maybe three of the division heads, are really, really conservative, don't like to do anything with any risk at all. And so they may be actually operating so far below the risk tolerance that they actually are losing business, losing opportunities. They should be more aggressive. They should be more out in the marketplace more. And there might be two of the ones, or one that's just crazy, that just will take every risk known to man. That one person could put the entire enterprise at risk. That's this internal framework. So they put these controls in place to monitor what all five of those divisions are doing, how they're doing it, and to monitor it in real time so they can catch when a business is got too much risk or too little risk. Could you repeat the question again? I think I went off the rails again on that.
No, it's just within the overall strategy of the company, where is the importance of ERM?
Yeah, so enterprise risk is that the board communicates with the business so that the business operates as intended. And with that is that when there's these internal controls, they're monitoring the entire business in a systematic way, in a consistent way, to be able to judge if anybody is really going off the rails. And that helps to keep the businesses balanced and to make sure that the risk is within what's acceptable for the company. Now, key is that things can change very, very quickly. So as soon as COVID hit in February, March, 2020, that a lot of boards decided different things. Now, maybe they wanted to hoard cash. Maybe they wanted to go ahead. Maybe they're a retailer and they thought this is our chance to go to curbside pickup. We have some local convenience stores here in Lansing, Michigan, mid-Michigan. They invested heavily and quickly in apps for online ordering and delivery services because they hadn't had delivery services. They were the corner convenience store. And they all of a sudden, they got a lot of wallet share from a lot of us, like our family, because they had the curbside pickup so much sooner than anybody else. So the board, at that point, the board of directors might have said, whoa, everybody, hold off on any new projects. They could push a button all across the company. Those projects could stop. The risk, anything risky at all went away because they wanted to have the cash and they wanted to focus the business on what was optimal, which was moving to the curbside pickup and having the apps for ordering. So that system, that internal controls allowed the corporation to be very flexible. So it's having things under control. And for us from the food safety side, from the food fraud side, the reason why we like these systems is that we now know how we're being judged, how that project's being judged. We can calibrate our problem against other problems. A lot of times in food safety, we think that they don't understand. We start talking science and they don't understand us. But the thing with this is then now we're talking about these, we're putting that into the finance terms and we can be truly understood. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much, John, for taking the time to present for us. It looks like that was the last question in the box. If anybody had any other questions, maybe, something more specific to your situation that you didn't want to ask live on the air, that's totally fine. We understand. If you wanted to shoot any questions, John's contact information is obviously on the screen right there. If you wanted to check out the MOOC programs and, historically what's been involved there, that link is on the screen as well. I didn't even realize that was there. There's a QR code there. If you want to whip your phone out really quick and scan that code and get that textbook link, feel free to do so. And as I mentioned at the beginning, a recording of the webinar from today, if you missed maybe the beginning or you wanted to share it with someone else in your organization, the recording will be posted on our YouTube channel and the slides will be available from our website at pgrfsi.com. John, from everybody here at PGRFSI, thank you again for another fantastically informative webinar. I wish we could have you on every week, just from the ease of working with you and as well as the thoroughness of your presentations. But we are definitely looking forward to our next session with you. And we hope to see everyone else on a future webinar. So thank you all for attending.
Thank you.
Everyone have a great day and we'll see you next time.